The entire development discourse is about to get disrupted because of the scale of this crisis. So we need to rethink everything.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. There's only so much adapting you can do with so few resources. And that's a warning from Asif Saleh, the executive director of BRAC, about the impact of the climate crisis in Bangladesh. Bangladesh is where BRAC was founded more than 50 years ago, but today it partners with more than 100 million people across the global south, helping them to escape poverty and realize their potential. Asif joins me now from Dhaka. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks, Asif. Delighted to have you here.
Thank you so much, Tim. Great to be here.
BRAC is active in all sorts of projects, and coping with the climate emergency is only one of them. But does it have the potential to undermine your good work in so many other areas?
Oh, hugely. We, as in like people who work in development and other spaces, tend to look at things very sectoral. It's like, you know, I'm doing health, I'm doing poverty, I'm doing water and sanitation or education or climate. But when you go down at that household level of impacted population, all the issues are connected. Mm-hmm. So BRAC always looked at issues very holistically, or from the very problem-specific way that solutions have to be problem-centric, and that may require multiple things to come together. And for example, poverty is extremely multidimensional. There is no one magic bullet. So it's not just income poverty. It's about social classes. It's about structures. It's about lack of education. So you need to attack it from multiple fronts. And when you ask that, do we see a regression? Absolutely. I mean, we see that the areas where we had done good work on poverty alleviation, those areas we see regression. On the other hand, we also see that where the impact of climate change is the highest, there is also much more poverty in those areas as well. So there is a correlationality in that aspect. So in many ways, it's not just true for Bangladesh, but for many other parts, particularly the developing countries, which are the worst sufferers. This is a major problem. So we need to kind of take a step back and not look at it just as a climate change problem, but it's how do we tackle it in a way which is very comprehensive and multidimensional that essentially makes the more vulnerable community more shockproof. And so it's a bit of development work, it's a bit of humanitarian work, and it's a bit of climate science coming together and supporting all of this to reduce risk as a whole.
Now, you know a great deal about these vulnerable communities. The quote that I began with, I took that from one of two videos that you've made now when you visited the front line of climate change in Bangladesh. You did it in 2022 and it again in 2023. Who did you meet when you were there? What did you see?
I go to the field all the time, but I took the cameras this two times because this story of people at the coastal areas and people at the front line of climate change, how they are suffering and how they are coping, they're not really told in the global discourses as the way it should be told. People think sometimes that climate change is something that is happening, but the worst of it is going to happen, 20 years, 30 years down the road. But it's not linear like that. When seawater is rising, it may not be taking over your land, but the salinity in the lands across in the coastal areas, that's already increasing because the saltwater is creeping in. And when you have areas where it is predominantly the livelihood is based on farms and agriculture, so there's immediately lands are lost in terms of cultivation. So that impacts livelihood. That impacts scarcity of water. There is true understanding of how this is already impacted and at what scale. So I wanted to tell that story in person from their eyes. That was one part of it. But the second part of it was how people are coping. They're not waiting for assistance to come, but at the same time, they're trying to cope by their indigenous solutions, their own ways, but they can only go so much because this is a continuous battle against shocks and crises and disasters. If some of these could have been supported by additional external support, they could have magnified and amplified it in many fold. So this is not charity. I wouldn't say even compensation, but even this is a legitimate ask from all of the people here that financing to support some of the locally led solution really needs to come to the ground, which is not happening. And this is one of the major advocacy points for BRAC as an organization to see more of these resources getting channeled to Global South countries on the ground. And we hear all these numbers of trillions and billions. I don't even see the millions or even thousands.
You're a busy person. I imagine you could fill your week twice over meeting politicians and donors and policymakers. Why do you carve out time to go to the front line and see these things in person?
Yeah, I mean, BRAC is a very large organization. We have almost close to 100,000 staff. There are a lot of complexities, but end of the day, BRAC exists because we want to solve problems of the people, particularly living in the margin. These are things you cannot sit on a building and get a true understanding of. Mm-hmm. I mean, you want to directly talk to the people. You want to directly understand and feel what they're doing. So I make it a point that at least, you know, a few days in the month, I actually am on the ground and I'm talking directly and not necessarily very scheduled visits, but just visits where I get to be there and talk to people and see and feel what sort of challenges people are facing. So that is very, very important. I think part of the challenges in the development sector is that people who are coming up with solutions, they are too far from the problems. Mm. And that's why it's not necessarily always very, very effective. So I think people closest to the problem has the best solutions as well.
It's almost more true of the impact of climate change than anything, because as you say, the numbers get towards the hundreds of billions and the trillions in this, and this creates a certain abstraction in the problem. If you are going to solve this, this has to start community by community and household by household.
Exactly. And also, I think to a certain extent, with the billions and trillions of numbers, people also get desensitized and they think that, oh my God, this problem is so big. Where do I even start? So I think the conversation also needs to shift on solutions as well. So models, which ones are effective? What's the cost? Which ones are scalable? What can we take from one place to another? What works in Africa? What works in Bangladesh? What works in drought? What works in floods? What works in land erosions? And so there are many, many dynamics. The entire development discourse is about to get disrupted because of the scale of this crisis. So we need to rethink everything in terms of how we have designed programs in the past and how we have scaled things. So it's a very, very different frontier.
It is remarkable watching the videos, and you spoke about this already, to see how resourceful individual households and communities are in coping with the problems of climate change. They're resourceful, they work hard, they are entrepreneurial as well. And is there a problem with this, perhaps, that their efforts, because they are as good as they could possibly be, end up delaying action, but they're only going to be good for a couple of years? They can't provide these long-term solutions that they desperately need.
Yeah, it is a problem. Right now, this is coping mechanism. They are coping, but they're not thriving. They're not going up the ladder. If you look at, say, Bangladesh's history, Bangladesh being at the front line and seventh most vulnerable country in the world for climate change. Now, Bangladesh used to be second poorest country in the world when it got independence in 1971. Now it's the 35th largest economy in the world and have done very well. And that's mainly due to like a people being very resilient, resourceful, entrepreneurial, and also all the supports that it got from governments, non-state actors. So it has been a very remarkable development story in many ways for all the right ingredients. But essentially now we also are kind of looking at a point that a lot of these gains maybe get undone because of things that are not within our control. So people are coping, but unless they get the support both from the infrastructure side, both the human development side, the path towards realizing our own potential, not moving from one crisis to another, that's getting disrupted. We have more and more districts that are going to be more vulnerable for different reasons. There are other countries that are in similar space. Last year, I went to UN General Assemblies in Anga during New York, and I was listening to the Minister of Maldives, who was saying very similar things, that we have been told that don't do adaptation, we need to do mitigation, so there's not going to be any money for adaptation. But soon that story changed because people realized that we need to do some level of adaptation because we're not going to be able to keep it down under 1.5 degrees. There's a less likelihood. But then when we went for money, they said, okay, you need to have a plan. Now our plans are ready. everything is ready for a few years, but we don't see financing on the ground, right? So that's essentially Brack's story as well, that last few years we have been preparing a lot of these, identifying these models, what works, what solution. In a place where you don't have access to drinkable groundwater, how do you kind of manage to harness rainwater and be able to filter it? How do you do reverse osmosis of salted water? All of these solutions are on the ground, but we are not being able to scale them because of lack of finance. Whether I go to Davos or whether I go to all these COPs, so one track, very much focused on mitigation and energy reduction, because that's where the private capital is flowing. But on the other hand, adaptation, you don't have a lot of business. It should be the other way around. You're talking about human beings. It's not charity. People already are coming up with solutions that really need to be strengthened and scaled up. But the focus is not there. So it's quite frustrating in many ways.
So let's talk a little bit more about what Brack is doing and how its climate adaptation solutions are planned and delivered. What is your focus?
Last few years, we tried to look at adaptation in slightly also some fragmented way. Like, for example, in coastal towns in the south of Bangladesh, we saw that the water crisis was the predominant crisis. So we tried to identify few alternative water solutions. We looked at livelihood changes that are happening amongst the people. You know, I was giving you the example of people losing their land because of not only for land erosion, but also salinity. We were looking at alternative agriculture methods. So how do you give agri-farmers salinity-tolerant seeds for rice or for other type of crops so that they can grow it and they can still have access to livelihood? So there are different types of livelihood solutions. We introduced crop insurance as well in case of disasters. You know, how do you kind of protect people's investment, particularly farmers, disaster resilient housing, but make it affordable and resilient. We're working with MIT on how do you use very sophisticated satellite imagery to do some long-term forecasting in terms of how the climate will change in one particular vulnerable district of Bangladesh and trying to then prepare the community accordingly. So all of these we have done in isolation in different areas to try and tweak and test out the model, because that's how Brack operates. So before we try to scale up, we go with this hypothesis and then we do learn on the ground as we are doing while learning at the same time, learning by doing basically. We have seen certain successes and certain failures of the model. Now we are going in a very comprehensive way. And from our experiences on the ground, we are seeing that climate adaptation really comprehensively has four different tracks that needs to be tackled in multiple points. One is about lack of critical services. This is a more service, which is humanitarian, access to drinking water, which leads to other health crises. In coastal areas, we are seeing different types of diseases for women, UTI, cervical cancers have gone up. For men, the strokes, hypertension have gone up because of lack of access to proper drinking water. The second pillar of our work is around livelihood and agriculture, reskilling people, doing different types of agriculture extension work. Third pillar is about risk reduction. There are crises going to happen. So how do you reduce the risk through these all types of interventions like housing and insurance and other things? And the fourth pillar is that after doing all of these, the whole goal is to reduce displacement of people, but land will be lost and people will be displaced. So how do you prepare the nearby cities to be more climate migrant friendly? So here we are working with the mayors, the planners to do that. This is our four-pronged approach, and now we are going in two areas. One is a drought-prone area in the northeast of Bangladesh, and one is a coastal area in the south of Bangladesh, and doing it very comprehensively, holistically, with researchers plugged in to evaluate and say that how this adaptation is happening. So it's a very, very comprehensive model. And also some of these individual models, like in water, we are now looking for additional financing to scale up some of these so that we can have more areas which at least gets those critical services.
You did say that you learn by doing. And I note that each year Brack produces something called the Failure Report, which is a rather unusual document for someone like yourself to produce to talk about your failures. What's behind this? How does this fit with this approach?
Oh, this is so central to everything that we do in the development space. there's too much about all the pilots see successes, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is that whole open secret that no pilots can fail, because if it fails, then you don't get funding from the donor again. So in a way, it's a donor NGO collusion. That's not how we operated over the last 52 years. Our first grant we got, I think, from Oxfam, after spending most of the money, when we had about a few $1,000 left, we went back to the donor and went to return the check. The donor was very surprised that, why are you returning the check? Because, you know, you can do something with it. And that's the DNA of the organization, essentially, that you are not necessarily know everything when you write the proposal.
Mm-hmm.
Once you start things on the ground, you realize that a lot of things don't go according to plan. What you thought would work doesn't work. So you need to have that ability or agility to tweak the model, change it, and we continuously have donor conversations about it and then update it. So oftentimes, what the way the proposal was written and the way the project ended, it looked very different, because certain things are bound to fail. Any experiments you do, you know, and you're talking about human beings as well, changing behaviors. So oftentimes, there are so many different factors or different types of stakeholders that it doesn't work. We are very open about talking about failures. Internally, we are very critical about how we look at things. And there is that continuous focus on end impact. The story of how BRAC grew, it wasn't a planned growth that BRAC is going to be this huge NGO with so many different social enterprises and development programs with 100,000 employees, international operations. This was never the plan. But it's a problem-solving approach that when you know that you are trying to solve a problem, you then realize that there are certain gaps that need to be filled as well. Maybe I give you an example. When you're talking about increasing income of rural population, say with the microfinance, a lot of people, first thing they do is buy a cow, because they can sell the milk, they can get a daily income, and then have access to an asset which grows, and they can sell the asset later anytime.
Yeah.
The end goal is about increasing income of and assets of the people. But then suddenly you see that either probably due to lack of vaccination, the cow dies, or suddenly in the village, there are too many milk producers and you're not enough demand. So your price goes down. So your income doesn't go up. So we then set up a group of people who were vaccinating these cows, trained them, and that became a social enterprise themselves. Then we created social enterprises to sell the milk in the urban areas to help them link to the market. These did not happen on a prefabricated plan. This happened as we were doing it. We were learning it. Some things were failing. And then we were like, okay, so maybe we should approach this in a different way. So having that long-term view and not having that very three-year short-term project view, that was very, very important. And acknowledging failures and then learning from it and doing things a bit differently, that was always a big part of it. We just formalized it in a way through this failure report to kind of also do this so that people in the sector as a whole become more comfortable talking about failure, because it's very important for development.
In these huge challenges like climate adaptation, we're constantly reminded that the biggest constraint is poverty. The households you are trying to help have no resources, they have no savings. In trying to make climate adaptation possible, to make it work, how big a role is poverty reduction?
Extreme poverty and climate adaptation will have to go hand in hand. So we have to not only have additional ability for people to increase their income, we need to give them additional ability to improve their savings mechanisms, improve their resilience mechanisms through products like insurance. And we have to do it at large volumes. The poorer people are, the more vulnerable they are, and they're prone to disasters and shocks.
Mm-hmm.
These are countries where you don't have any social safety net. The first idea of starting BRAC happened after a cyclone in 1970 in Bangladesh, where almost 5 million people died. And so when he went to visit those areas, his first instinct was that, yes, we can see that the cyclone killed all these people, but it's really poverty that led them to come to these areas and take these all these risks, and not having access to a proper shelter, not having access to services, that led them to death. Unless we address the root cause and improve resilience, then we are not going to be able to address the issue of climate adaptation. a lot of the existing development work has to be made climate smart, if I can use a jargon. But then in the development space and humanitarian space, when you talk to climate scientists, these are very different conversations you have. But at the intervention level, it will be a nexus of all these three. So you need humanitarian support during disaster and pre-disaster in some form, like in health and other places. You need traditional poverty eradicating livelihood services. And you also need the best of science to come and help people on the ground as well, like we are doing with the MIT project. So all of this needs to come together to have a proper, comprehensive adaptation model for the most vulnerable community.
So as you said, you are driven by the evidence, even if you are improving on the evidence as you experiment with these programs. When you're trying to put programs into practice, is it the case that we know enough already? There are just problems with operationalizing what we know from research sometimes, or are there gaps in our knowledge still?
There are gaps in our knowledge. I actually started thinking about it during COVID because the knowledge space is very much also dominated by Global North. What are priority areas? What works? What doesn't work? Still is very much seen from a Global North perspective. When COVID happened, first shock of COVID, I just took over my role just a couple of months ago, and then COVID hit us. And suddenly, not only all our workers at risk, but we also had to be on the ground for the health response. Mm-hmm. And we also were seeing all our clients and program participants, how dire their state was at that time. These models were coming out from various colleges and universities, which predicted thousands of people are going to die. So the policy solution was lockdown. Mm-hmm. And it was very much based on research and evidence done in the Global North. And in a sense, because like lockdown worked perfectly well in Western countries because of social protection services and, you know, work from home. It doesn't work when 87% of the economy is informal, mm-hmm. where people have to be out on the street to make a living. So it was very much driven from a global public health perspective, but not looking at the economic impact. So you couldn't keep people inside their homes without doing a large-scale cash transfer on their homes, because how will they make a living? Have we tested alternative methods like hand washing, mask wearing, which will complement or be a potential alternative to lockdown as well? We saw that there were no big research done on these cases. So one of the big study that Professor Mushfiq Mubarak did at that time, who also happens to be from Bangladesh, mm-hmm. was this landmark mask study, which was very important because at that time, I think just a month later, like in March 2020, me and Richard Cash wrote a piece on CGD where we wrote this piece about the importance of research and knowledge in these alternative areas, which also looks at the realities of the Global South. There is a missing gap in other areas as well. The adaptation space, whether you look at the realities in terms of particularly the informal economy, the role it plays, I think there is a big knowledge gap around there. So oftentimes it's very much looked at very formal sector-based economy where everything, the system works. We need to do more in terms of injecting that dose of reality in the knowledge space as well.
And a previous life before you were doing this job, you worked in the financial sector for a while. We speak a lot about climate finance as a way to help solve these problems of climate change. When you're in a fishing village in Bangladesh, it is literally thousands of miles away, anything to do with climate finance. How important is this going to be in solving the problems that you see?
It is going to be very important if it's channeled the right way, but there is a huge gap right now. I mean, if you look at some of the researches that has been done, the numbers are quite staggering. So based on the plans that these developing countries have done in terms of adaptation, so there is a need for almost $387 billion for adaptation overall. And so far, according to the OECD figures, the numbers that have been allocated is about $24.6 billion. But then Oxfam did a study to look at separating some of these numbers from what are the real climate numbers versus what are the traditional development numbers. So that number drops down to about 11.5 billion. So that means out of the total need, about 2.9% of the needs are being met. And even if you look at that, how much money is actually coming to locally led organization, locally led adaptation model, mm-hmm. that's even less than 3%. It's 3% of the 2.9% that is being allocated. So it's not a surprise that I'm screaming for money for scale. You can imagine what's happening to much smaller NGOs as well. There's simply not much out there which is kind of seeing the light on the ground for scale. So this is going to be a big factor, but it's not the only factor. Money needs to be not going to so many of these intermediaries. You know, we need to be effective, efficient, because there are too many crises right now around the world. Mm-hmm. They're scrambling for resources. So we need to be very efficient in terms of how we spend this money. That means that locally led organizations, evaluations done properly, look at the impact, effectiveness, than spending so much money on overhead and all these intermediaries, agencies, and other things. So it's very, very important that we cut all the flares and just focus on the core of what works.
Yes, you've also spent some time in government roles as well. But has that taught you about this problem of making sure that that policy, the money that a government can apply to problems like this, are getting that efficiently and quickly and appropriately to where the problem is?
As part of being a non-stick civil society actor, we do have to advocate on both sides. I mean, it's about local action, but also global conversation. At the same time, we have to locally continuously be the check and balance for the government to ensure that there is money being spent transparently, money being spent on the right projects. But the reality is there is not much money out there that the government have access to right now. What they have is the plan as per the prescriptions that have come in terms of that you need a plan, and we have the plan now. Now we need to mobilize the resources to ensure that this aspect gets spent in the right way.
You mentioned earlier that you go to Davos and the COPs. You are in the room when these big picture solutions are being debated. What's your emotion when you're there? Do you feel that what is being talked about at the moment is appropriate for the problems that you see when you are visiting those households? Do you feel that they are going to grasp the nature of the problem appropriately in time?
I feel grateful that I have access to these places. I can go, I am in the room. My role is to inject a dose of reality from the perspective of the most vulnerable. The kind of urgency that should be there, I don't see that. It's often, yes, it's all good and dandy, but there is not a lot of action that follows. Part of it is about financing, but part of it is how to get things done. What are those models? That's not the conversation that is happening. Private capital is flowing in areas where money to be made, mm-hmm. and that means renewable energy, which is very important. But at the same time, from the most vulnerable countries, the climate financing, the models that needs to be supported for scale, that's missing. And that's enormously frustrating, because we are not just depending on the big governments anymore. There are a lot of foundations who are coming up to support climate work, but I don't see any philanthropic foundations stepping up and supporting the adaptation work. Mitigation is important, don't get me wrong, but adaptation is about really helping these most vulnerable people. They need the support very urgently. We need to inject that urgency and realism in these global climate conversations.
Let us hope that those conversations change soon. As you say, we're running out of time. Asif Salim, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jim.
If you want to have a look at those videos, they are on YouTube. Search for "How are people adapting to survive at the climate front lines?" Also, if you want to find out more about what BRAC is doing, go to brac.net, where you also find those extraordinary failure reports, which are a fascinating read. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. Wherever you get your podcasts, you will find us there. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org.